Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for October 2014. This is issue number 357, and I'm your host, Fred Bobie. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. My email for general inquiries is fvobie, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. My telephone number for short calls is area code 419-228-6223. Keep in mind that I'm away a lot, so you may not get a return call as promptly as you may wish. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $30. To subscribe or renew, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. And if you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. Well, I sure could have used the assistance of DX Audio Service members last month as we had a major meltdown, a computer glitch with our duplicator system, which did some crazy things. It seems that some members received the July issue for their Part 1 disc and the October issue for their Part 2. Where the problem became very crucial and critical was we had two things occurring at the same time. One was I was away visiting my brother who was having heart surgery in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I couldn't be home to answer the phone calls. And if I was home, I'm not sure I could have answered them because apparently we took a lightning hit which wiped out the call blocker and the answering machine and pretty much all the phone equipment we have. So we weren't getting the calls. This made a lot of members kind of freak out and start calling other people asking what to do. Again, I'd like to emphasize, if you get a bad disc, please send it back. It's very important that we get that disc back, and when you send it back, that's the signal to me that you need a new disc. Since we were unable to figure out who got the bad part ones, we went ahead and reran the entire Part 1 and mailed it to all the membership. So if you got duplicate copies of the October Part 1, just go ahead and throw one of the discs away. In the future, we'd like to have the bad disc back. Unfortunately, that's going to take a big hit on our treasury for this month. If you call, I'm going to tell you, send it back. If you call a member of the board of directors, they're going to tell you, send it back. It's the same no matter where you go. Send it back. It will be replaced. Because we didn't get hardly any discs back, we're still unable to track where the problem might have occurred in the duplicator system because each disc has a serial number and an ID which tells us the sequence in which it was recorded. So, we cross our fingers this month and hope everyone gets a correct disc. In the future, if you get a bad disc, please just send back the bad disc. No need to send any other discs back. No need to call. No need to write letters. No need to comment. Just send it back. Now, let's go over to Mr. Dave Alpert with a look at the AM Switch.
Welcome to the October edition of the AM Switch, which, if you're keeping count, is volume 81. Issue number 30. Let's start out with call letter changes. 700-WWBZ. Orange, Athol, Massachusetts, gets big by changing to WFAT. 1110, KYKK, Humble City, New Mexico, can't make up their mind as they call change to KPER on August 21st, then to KEJL on September 1st. 1190, KPHN, Kansas City, Missouri, changes to KDMR. 1230, KYSM, Mankato, Minnesota, changes to KFSP. The FSP stands for Fox Sports. 1360, KAHS, El Dorado, Kansas, is now KPHN. 1480, WTKD, Mobile, Alabama, is changing to WERM. By the way, the buyers of WDRJ 1440 Inkster, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit, have reserved call letters WMKM for when the sale is final. The nine towers with different day and night patterns shoot to the east-northeast into Detroit. New station watch, we have one call change for a new station nearing licensing. 890 KDPP Olivehurst, California changes calls to KMJE. The CP for this new station applied for a license to cover back in June. Here's one station making a change to their existing construction permit. 1380 KVSM Santa Maria, California applies for making minor adjustments to night pattern. The CP for this new station already has program test authority. One station has been assigned call letters to their CP. The CP on the construction permit on 1340 in Fairbanks, Alaska. New station, U1, 1,000 watts day and night, assigned to KSDG. Okay, now we have full applications for new stations filed after winning auction 84 bids. They include 850 in Enola, Pennsylvania, 1200 in Chugiak, Alaska, 1470 Coalinga, California, and 1490 in Bozeman, Montana, which has specified U1, 1000 watts day, 900 watts night. One CP for a new station has been canceled, 880 in Wasilla, Alaska, for U1, 210 watts day and night. Canceled at permittee's request. One auction 84 winning bid dismissed, 1450 in Montoursville, Pennsylvania, U1, 1,000 watts day and night. And a new station application dismissed, 1590 in Cheyenne, Wyoming, for a new station, U4, 1 kilowatt day and night, dismissed. Here are some stations going dark. 1150 WUTI, Utica, New York, has been silent since May 23, 2013. The FCC sent a letter to the station on August 11th informing it that its license has automatically expired for being silent more than a year. 1230 WTKN Corinth, Mississippi has been silent since June 1st, 2012. Its license was canceled automatically by the FCC in an August 26th letter to the licensee. 1410 KRIL, Odessa, Texas, had its license canceled as of July 17th. No explanation on the FCC website. Let's take a look at construction permits for existing stations. CPs licensed and on the air. 550 WAYR, Fleming Island, Florida. Their CP for U4, 5 kilowatts day, 500 watts night. With a city of license change from Orange Park, but no changes in the transmitter site, is now on. 1060 KBFL, Springfield, Missouri's CP for U1, 470 watts day, 19 watts night from a new site, is on the air. A couple of NRC members have heard this one, so they appear to be getting out quite well. 1230 KZYM, Joplin, Missouri's CP for U1, 560 watts day, 600 watts night, is on. 1240 WEZR Lewiston, Maine's CP for 1,000 watts day, 860 watts night, is on. 1480 WEEO Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. Their CP for U1, 410 watts day and a mighty 9 watts at night, is also on. And 1510 WJKN Jackson, Michigan has its CP for D1, 380 watts from a new site on the air. D1 is daytime only. Let's take a look at applications for CPs from existing stations now. 720 WHYF Sharmanstown, Pennsylvania applies to move to a new site and diplex the auction 84 winner at Enola, Pennsylvania at 850. WHYF has been using a temporary antenna for years. 1020 WURN Kendall, Florida applies to modify their day pattern. 1260 WSHU Westport, Connecticut applies for U1 650 watts day, 17 watts night, and also proposed changing their city of license to Seymour, Connecticut. 1310 WTTL Madisonville, Kentucky applies for a construction permit to delete directional facilities and become U1. 1,500 watts day, 40 watts at night. 1410 WDOE Dunkirk, New York, does the same thing as they apply for U1, a kilowatt day, 31 watts night from their current site, dropping from three towers to just one. 1440 WLXN Lexington, North Carolina, applies for U1, 5,300 watts day, 1,000 watts at night, moving their day site to a new tower while maintaining current night site and facilities. One application for CP dismissed, 1320 KSDT, Hemet, California. They had an application to move to Redlands with U4, 550 watts day and 950 watts night. It's been dismissed. Now let's take a look at special temporary authority grants. When a station can't operate at their normal parameters, they have to obtain an STA, or special temporary authority, and we have more than a few. 570 WWNC, Asheville, North Carolina, granted an STA for U1, 5,000 watts day, 1,250 watts night due to ongoing tower problems. 600 WFST, Caribou, Maine, granted an STA with U1, 1 kilowatt day, 127 watts night due to transmitter failure. We assume they're using a borrowed one at the moment. 600 KSJB, Jamestown, North Dakota, granted an STA with U1 with a power of 1,250 watts day, 500 watts night from the adjacent KSJZ FM tower while the AM towers are rebuilt. 770 WVNN, Athens, Alabama, granted an STA with D1, 7,000 watts daytime due to weather damage on the night tower link. 950 KJTV, Lubbock, Texas, applies for an STA with U4, 3,000 watts day and 500 at night. They say their transmitter needs a part. 960 WELI, New Haven, Connecticut, granted an STA with parameters at variance. 1010 KTNZ, Amarillo, Texas, granted an STA with U4, 3,000 watts day, 500 at night, saying their transmitter is malfunctioning. 1050 WTKA, Ann Arbor, Michigan, granted an STA with U4, 2,500 watts day, 125 watts night, due to parameters at variance. They were 10,000 watts day, 500 night. 1160 WYLL, Chicago, Illinois, granted an STA because their night parameters are at variance, meaning the pattern is not going where it's supposed to be. 1170 KPUG, Bellingham, Washington, granted an STA for U1, 1,250 watts day and night due to tower problems. 1190 WLIB, New York, New York, granted an STA with parameters at variance during installation of new voltage sampling system. Same with 1200 KYAA, Soquel, California, parameters at variance. 1240 KNRY, Monterey, California, granted an STA with reduced, which is unspecified, power and tower height. According to the filing, the top 70 feet of their 210-foot tower is being replaced. 1260 KLYC, McMinnville, Oregon, has an STA with U1, 1 kilowatt day, 212 watts night, citing phasing system problems. 1300 KRZS, Searcy, Arkansas, granted an STA with D1, 1,000 watts from an auxiliary transmitter. 1300 WJMO, Cleveland, Ohio, is granted an STA with U1, 1,250 watts day and night for occasional tower work. 1310 WDTW, Dearborn, Michigan, has an STA with U1, 900 watts day and night from an emergency antenna. Wonder if this is being done to keep the license from canceling. 1380 WKDM, New York, New York, has an STA for U4, 5,000 watts day and night for unspecified reasons. 1430 WENE, Endicott, New York, is granted an STA with U1, 5,000 watts day, 1,250 watts night on occasion while ATU buildings are replaced. 1580 WJFK, Morningside, Maryland, has been granted an STA with parameters at variance, while WUST, 1120, and WZHF, 1390, are diplexed into their tower system. 1590 KCTY, Wayne, Nebraska, granted an STA with parameters at variance during FM diplexing, We are seeking clarification on this, as it makes no sense for an AM station to diplex into an FM antenna, or vice versa. Applications to extend existing STAs received from and granted to several stations to overcome interference from stations outside the United States. WDAE 620, St. Petersburg, Florida, for U2, 11,200 watts day, 11,000 watts night, to overcome Cuban QRM. WINZ 940, Miami, Florida's STA, gives them U2 50,000 watts day, 25 kilowatts night, to overcome QRM from Cuba. WTLN 950, Orlando, Florida, has U2 12,000 watts day, 1,100 watts night, for overcoming QRM from Cuba. And KTCT 1050 San Mateo, California, has an STA for U3 50,000 watts day and night to overcome Mexican QRM. Since it's October and since it's time for Halloween, it's going to be a spooky visit to the morgue, otherwise known as our silent stations list. These are stations informing the FCC that they are silent. 1130 WALQ, Carville, Alabama, silent on August 15th due to financial problems. 1190 KNEK, Washington, Louisiana, went silent July 30th due to transmitter malfunction. 1220 KQMG, Independence, Iowa, went off the air September 2nd because of equipment problems. As we heard last month, 1270 WHEO in Stuart, Virginia, went silent September 1st. It's due to financial difficulties. 1340 WKSN, Jamestown, New York, is now silent as of July 15th because of technical problems, but should be back on soon. 1350 WNVA, Norton, Virginia, went silent August 14th due to extreme financial difficulties. 1360 WGBN, McKeesport, Pennsylvania, suburb of Pittsburgh, went silent August 10th due to computer problems. 1360 WHJC, Matewan, West Virginia, silent August 9th after a severe storm caused damage to this station the night of August 8th. 1440 WSEL, Pontotoc, Mississippi, went silent August 12th due to transmitter problems and lack of money to fix it. 1450 WZGX, Bessemer, Alabama, is now silent, according to a member's report. No details from the FCC site about why. 1490 WSYL, Sylvania, Georgia, went silent August 27th with transmitter trouble. 1540 WYCL, Niles, Ohio, went silent August 16th due to problems with their directional array. And in addition, WHGH 840, Thomasville, Georgia, was added back to the FCC silent list on August 8th, but this seems to be an error. If there's a member down yonder who can let us know if they're on or off, we would like to know. Rising from the dead like a zombie, looking like Phil Wayne, are these formerly silent stations informing the FCC they're no longer silent. 870 WTIM, Assumption, Illinois, was silent since May 9th as WINU, Shelbyville. They came back on as WTIM August 1st. 910 WAEI, Bangor, Maine, was silent since September 1st, 2013. WAEI came back on the air August 28th at 09:55 local time. 910 KWDZ, Salt Lake City, Utah, went silent August 17th, 2013. They returned to the air this year, August 14th. 1400 WPCE, Portsmouth, Virginia, fell silent October 1st, 2013. Back on August 14th with a 250-watt STA. 1440 KPTO, Pocatello, Idaho, has been silent since November 23rd, 2013. They came back on July 5th. And finally, 1680 KRJO, Monroe, Louisiana, returned to the air August 20th after a few months off the air. That ringing in your ears is not tinnitus or tinnitus. It's the FCC's cash register. Time to take a look at FCC fines. KRGS 690 Rifle, Colorado, and KRGV 95.5, both fined $1,000 for failure to maintain complete public inspection files at the station. WOYK 1350, York, Pennsylvania, was fined $5,600 for failure to enclose the antenna with an effective locked fence. And here's some Canadian news from Andy at the World Radio TV Handbook. 570 CBNK Cartwright, Newfoundland, which was an LPRT, is now deleted, moved to FM. The applicant for 600 Surrey, British Columbia, has been denied the application for a new station. Two applicants for 600 kHz in Vancouver, British Columbia, have been denied applications for new stations. 650 CISL Richmond, British Columbia, has been granted a CP for 20,000 watts day and 4,000 watts night from a new site. No information yet on the antenna patterns. 690 CBDO, Fort Simpson, Northwest Territories. This LPRT is now deleted. They've moved to FM. And finally, the CRTC is investigating whether three Washington State stations, KRPA 1110, KRPI 1550, and KVRI 1600, are illegally targeting the Vancouver, British Columbia market. The problem is not U.S. law, as the FCC couldn't care less what U.S. stations broadcast. But Canadian advertisers are being reminded they can't take Canadian tax deductions for their ad costs on U.S. stations targeting Canadian markets without CRTC authorization. Will this policy starve these stations of revenue? Only time will tell. Before we leave, a question from Wayne. Can anyone monitor WEPG 910, WSDT 1240, or WSDQ 1190 and see if these three are simulcasting each other? We're getting mixed reports, and we'd like some clarity on these stations. With thanks to Wayne Heinen, Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, and Fred Vobey, that's it for the AM Switch. Remember, you can be a part of AM Switch simply by reporting what you hear, letting us know about silent stations, stations coming back on the air, or just observations you have on stations in your area. Call us at 419-741-0205. That's area code 419-741-0205. Call and leave a message on the Musings line. And now to Minneapolis, where Mark Durenberger is standing by with the Bandscan column. Mark wanted you to know that Minnesota's famed Northern Lights must have gotten into his recording, so you'll hear a bit of crackling here and there at the beginning of the Bandscan. Here you go, Mark.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, folks. We're about due for another State of the Station. You know, it's been a while since we did one of these, and we've had a lot of people asking us to do the Minneapolis market, so that's where we go this time. We've got a number of stations across the band that represent just about any type of broadcasting you could want. We start at the low end, which is 630. 630 once dominated the Twin Cities in the rock and roll days. The station signed on in 1951 at 1590 as WCOW, playing country and old-time music. In its early days, WCOW signed on with a cowbell. Not very successful, so the station transitioned to a female-oriented format with the call sign WISK in 1957, and the frequency was changed to 630 the next year. This format was also unsuccessful, so WISK tried a pop rock format that also bombed. The station was soon sold to Crowell Collier Broadcasting Company, which owned KFWB and KEWB in California. The top 40 format of those stations was used to launch the new KDWB in 1959. KDWB quickly became a major competitor to WDGY, which had been playing a pop music format. With the 630 frequency, KDWB called itself Channel 63, and the station began its long, uninterrupted run as a top-rated pop music station. KDWB and WDGY were fierce rivals throughout the 1960s and 70s. During the 1970s, the two top 40 stations saw new competition as KSTP 1500 and WYOO U100 picked up the format. Within the next 3 years, KDWB's top 40 rivals gradually dropped out. U100 would be sold. WDGY switched to country music in 1977. KSTP began to lean adult top 40 during the late 1970s. By the end of the decade, KDWB was the only top 40 station in town. Moves by emerging FM stations crippled 63 KDWB's longtime dominance since it was at a disadvantage with its AM signal. By 1986, the frequency was used as K63. WDGY 1130 would drop its call letters in 1991 to become KFAN, so KDWB's owner adopted the abandoned WDGY call sign for 630, where it remained until 2008. The new WDGY adopted a classic country music format, similar to what had been aired on 1130 throughout the 1980s. WDGY 630 switched to an adult standards format in 1993, which gave it a respectable boost in ratings. Then, land values appreciated to the point where the site of KDWB's towers was more valuable than the station. 630 went dark. In early 1997, it resurfaced in a neighboring market, airing a talk radio format that featured hosts like Don Imus, G. Gordon Liddy, and Don and Mike. Then, in 2001, a group of local Hispanic broadcasters turned the station into Radio Ray, and the transmitter was moved back closer to the Twin Cities around 2005. That allowed it to boost power and ID once again as part of the Twin Cities. In 2008, the WDGY call letters became WREY, and Radio Ray, or Radio Ray, is operating the Spanish format today. Oh, the WDGY call letters next went to a nearby 740 outlet. KFXN on 690 is known as Hmong Radio AM 690. It's essentially a daytime-only station broadcasting at 500 watts, though it does have a 4-watt signal during nighttime hours with very limited reach, this likely to protect CKGM in Montreal. The station signed on in 1962 with the KTCR call sign and a country music format. In 1983, under new ownership, the station became a jazz outlet as KTCJ. In 1997, when it was the sole remaining AM simulcasting in the market, KTCJ switched to classic country music and the call letters were changed to KXBR, the Bear. In December 1998, KXBR dropped country and became KFXN, a counterpart to sports formatted, co-owned KFAN 1130. The station was branded as Score 690. Clear Channel then moved KFXN programming to the HD2 channel on its FM sports station and announced it would donate the station. Through the Minority Media and Telecommunications Council Clear Channel Ownership Diversity Initiative. In September 2011, the station switched to an ethnic-based format catering to the local Hmong community. The station was sold by that initiative MMTC to Asian American Broadcasting in 2014. It is Hmong Radio today. On 770, we find KUOM, operated by the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, the oldest continuing station in the state and the oldest licensed non-commercial radio station in the country. Radio transmissions at the university date to 1912, when a professor named F.W. Springer began experimenting with broadcasts, though he probably just used a spark gap transmitter. Activities were suspended by World War I, but the station was broadcasting again by 1920. It was assigned the experimental call 9XI and provided reports on farm markets and weather. In February 1922, when a heavy snowstorm knocked out newswire services into the region, personnel at the Minneapolis Tribune convinced operators to help them retrieve the day's news through a roundabout series of amateur radio relays. The university received the first AM broadcast license in the state in January 1922 with the call sign WLB, and programming was extended to include lectures, concerts, and football games. In the 30s and 40s, the station broadcast a considerable amount of educational material and was used for distance learning, a practice that continued into the 1990s. The call sign was changed to KUOM on June 1st, 1945. The station's non-directional signal operates at 5,000 watts, and like most stations in the Midwest, it has comparable range to a full-power FM station due to the area's flat land and excellent soil conductivity. But it shuts off at sundown to protect WABC in New York. In the 1990s, KUOM was known as University of Minnesota Public Radio, not to be confused with Minnesota Public Radio, and it broadcast public affairs, arts, classical music, and a variety of other programming. Known as Radio K since 1993, the station now broadcasts a variety that has been praised by radio critics. WCCO 830 began broadcasting in 1922 as WLAG with 500 watts on 360 meters. It was known as the Call of the North. However, the station soon landed in financial trouble and closed down in 1924. Washburn Crosby Company, forerunner of General Mills, took over the station and renamed it WCCO for the company's initials. Broadcasts resumed less than 2 months later from its longtime transmitter site in Coon Rapids, first with the flat-top antenna common to early stations, and then in 1939 with a vertical antenna still standing today. WCCO was moved to 740 with a power upgrade to 5 kilowatts a day, 7.5 kilowatts at night, kind of unusual. In 1928, with the implementation of the Federal Radio Commission's General Order 40, CCO changed its frequency to 810 kilohertz and was granted clear channel status. It signed on with 50 kilowatts for the first time in September 1932. In the early 1930s, two new 300-foot towers were added to raise the flat top and increase the range of the station's signal. WCCO constructed a new 654-foot tower in Coon Rapids in 1939, although the broadcast frequency was changed to 830 as a result of the 1941 North American Radio Broadcasting Agreement, NARBA, the tower now is slightly too long for the frequency. Due to the station's power as well as Minnesota's flat landscape, WCCO boasted one of the largest coverage areas in the country before the breakup of the clear channels. At night, the station's signal typically reached across 28 U.S. states and three Canadian provinces. WCCO was considered a full-service station through most of its life. The format originally included a broad mix of music, which leaned toward traditional MOR and easy listening fare, until the 1980s, when the playlist shifted more toward adult contemporary. The music was gradually pushed out of the way by the early 1990s when the format was changed to all news talk. WCCO broadcasters were substantial celebrities across the Midwest. The station spent a lot of time broadcasting from farms and small towns across the area. Its weather forecasts routinely covered at least five states. WCCO also had a long-time reputation of being the station to tune to for emergency information, especially severe weather and school closings in winter. Listeners would call in during severe weather events and describe what they were seeing at their locations, supplementing information from the National Weather Service. Today, WCCO operates a news and talk-oriented format with a strong news element, opinion, and a number of features throughout the day. Like all such AM giants, the station once boasted ratings in the 30 to 50% range. Like most of the others, WCCO today lands in the middle of the pack, succumbing to FM dominance. 900 KTIS is known on air as Faith 900 KTIS, or by the network name Faith Radio. KTIS is operated by the University of Northwestern St. Paul and is a nonprofit, listener-supported radio station relying on donations from the local community. The station came on the air in 1949 and gradually upgraded its power to 50 kilowatts daytime, though only 500 watts night, as it must protect the Canadian channel. We find little else to say about this station other than the fact that from the time I was little, that was about 200 years ago, that 900 spot has always been KTIS. Moving to 950, KTNF began life as KRSI in 1958 with a 1 kilowatt three-tower setup, protecting stations to the south and west. The 950 AM frequency has been home to many formats and calls. KRSI was one of the first top 40 stations in the Twin Cities in the late 50s. In its most popular incarnation, from 1968 to 1972, it was simulcasting with KRSI FM as all-request radio. Over the years, the station has been through many formats, including Top 40 MOR, music you remembered in the late 50s and early 60s, Top 40 as request radio, country music, rock, new wave, known as Music Radio I-95, adult standards when they did Al Ham's Music of Your Life in the 80s, country music in the 80s, satellite delivered CHR, Hot Rock 950 KRSI 1984, oldies request radio 1985, hard rock, Z-Rock, known as KZOW 1988 to 1990, business radio network when it was KJJO 1990 to 92. There was R&B oldies as KSGS, Solid Gold Soul, satellite delivered except for morning drive, called 950 Solid Gold Soul. That was in 1995 and through 1999. Then Urban Adult Contemporary, The Touch, satellite delivered, business radio as KDOW, then KCCO, Business 950, and then News Talk as KSNB in 2004. The station was sold that year to a group that wanted a counterbalance to right-wing talk radio. It became the permanent home of Air America Minnesota, and one of its hosts, Al Franken, went on to become United States Senator from Minnesota. Air America ceased operations in January 2010. 950's latest image remains, though, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Also in the 900s is 980 KKMS, a 5-kilowatter licensed to Richfield, where it operates four towers DA2 from that Minneapolis suburb and has trouble covering both cities with a solid signal at night. 980 came to life in 1949 as WPBC for the People's Broadcasting Company. While network affiliation was still important, WPBC carried no network programming, staying live and local all day. The station in the early years played a variety of middle-of-the-road pop music and standards, and was even considered an innovator in the concept of singing jingles. At the outset, the station had a daytime-only authorization, single tower, and located right in the center of the Twin Cities metro area. The station and its new FM sister were sold to Fairchild in 1972. Fairchild subsequently dismissed the entire staff and overhauled both stations. On November 3, 1972, the AM station was relaunched as WYOO, picking up an oldies format with rock and roll included. A few days later, the FM became WRAH, programming an automated album-oriented rock format. Wags in the market put the calls together. They come out, "You-rah," and speculated Fairchild was going after sports, but that never happened. WCCO had a stranglehold. When the oldies format of WYOO started to slide in the ratings, more MOR music was added, but ratings slid even further. Fairchild contemplated selling the station. The general manager and program director, both of them hired from established Top 40 station KDWB, felt a major change needed to be made. The decision was made to change to a Top 40 hard rock format, in contrast to what they saw as the rigid, bland presentation of other similar stations in town. They kept the WYOO call letters to avoid the hassle and long process of changing. After being rebuffed in their planned use as Y100, as the station's moniker, the new station was christened U100. An interesting note was the placement on the AM dial. The AM broadcast at 980, the FM at 101.3. Management reasoned that back then all radios were analog. It seemed like the only number shown on that part of the dial was a big 100. So it was close enough to 980 and 101.3, close enough to 100 as far as they were concerned. The dial position was promoted similarly as near 10 or 100 on AM or FM. U100 was born in 1974 during a remote broadcast from the Minnesota State Fair. It quickly became the topic of conversation throughout the area, with its rowdy, outrageous mix of Top 40 and hard rock. During the next 2 years, U100 quickly became the most talked-about radio station in town. Competition was fierce in the format at the time, and compared to U100, WDGY, KDWB, and KSTP seemed a bit tame in their on-air presentation. In early 1976, Fairchild decided to put both stations on the market. The owner of Easy Listening, Beautiful Music, WAYL, was interested in an AM operation to simulcast Wales FM signal and expand coverage in parts of the metro area. U100 signed off for the last time in 1976. The following Monday, 980 AM came back on the air as WAYL. WAYL, whose mascot, surprisingly, was a whale, simulcast easy listening music on both 93.7 and 980 AM until 1982, when they briefly switched the AM station to light rock, first as KKSS and then to adult standards as KMFY in 1984. The AM station's somewhat eclectic format was unsuccessful, and it returned to simulcasting Whale FM until 1988, when Whale FM finally dropped easy music and switched to classic hits as KLXK. Whale's call letters and format remained on 980 before completely giving up on beautiful music and switching to a simulcast of the FM station. In December 1990, the AM station branched off from its FM sister. The station picked up the full-time syndicated network called Z-Rock. The new call letters became KMZZ and the music full-time hard rock and heavy metal. As the Z-Rock network itself later shifted to a more mainstream rock presentation, KMZZ 980 dropped them in 1993 and began programming an in-house automated hard rock format known as Mega Rock. That didn't last long, and the following May, 980 AM once again returned to simulcasting their FM sister station, now Active Rock KRXX 93X. When Entercom sold 93X to Cap Cities ABC in 1994, the AM station was not part of the deal, but 980 continued to simulcast the FM until a buyer could be found. Upon taking control of KRXX FM in March, ABC immediately changed the format to modern rock as KEGE, The Edge. AM 980's call letters would remain KRXX until finally picking up the KEGE call letters later that year. 980 was finally sold in 1996 to Salem Broadcasting, and the call letters switched to the current KKMS. Today, 980 programs a Christian-based religious format, primarily featuring ministry personnel and preachers. Wow, what a convoluted history. WCTS is the call you hear today on 1030. The station began life as a 250-watt signal on 1010 as WGHB. The call was WRCR by 1965 and WJSW by 1968. They were broadcasting polka music and various other music formats. And when station WMIN dropped its longtime call letters in 1972, WJSW grabbed them. By this time, it was airing a full-service, middle-of-the-road format. In the mid-80s, the station was able to begin its power increase steps to get it to 50 kilowatts day. This done in conjunction with a move to 1030, where the station would be able to operate with limited power directional at night, protecting WBZ. WMIN 1030 played country music from 1986 to 1988, and then flipped to an oldies format, which evolved into adult standards a year later. In 1993, Colfax Communications bought the station and turned it over to the Fourth Baptist Church in Minneapolis as part of an exchange for the church's FM station. 1030 WMIN became WCTS in 1993, and seminary programming remains to this day. The WMIN call immediately picked up by a Hudson, Wisconsin station at 740 and used there until 2008. When that station changed its call letters to WDGY. Wow, we're only halfway through our list here in this strange and interesting market, and so I think we're going to have to take a break. Fred's got the hook out. That means we better say 30 until next month around this same time, when we'll continue with part two of our State of the Stations, Minneapolis. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We encourage and welcome your response and suggestions to topics for the Bandscan column. Until we meet again, good listening, DXers.
From the Publication Center, we have news that the National Radio Club is now shipping the AM Radio Log 35th Edition. The AM Radio Log is a source of information for AM radio stations in the United States and Canada. The 35th Edition is 8.5 by 11, 3-hole punch, U.S. loosely format. This publication fits nicely into a 1-inch 3-ring binder. Additional references include call letters of FM simulcasts with the AM station listings, listing of regional groups of stations in the group section, it's a separate section of the logbook, a cross-reference of those stations that are licensed to use IBOC, in-band on-channel, and a comprehensive list of FM translators that are now simulcasting AM broadcasters. The book has a total of 296 pages. Order by snail mail, by check or money order in U.S. funds to the National Radio Club, Post Office Box 473-251, Aurora, Colorado 80047-3251. Or you can use your PayPal account at www.nrcdxas.org. And here's the cost. If you're a member in the United States, it's media rate $22.95 or priority mail $26.95. Non-member to the U.S., $28.95 media rate or $32.95 priority mail. Member or non-member to Canada, the price is $36 global priority mail, and outside the United States, the price is $40 global priority mail. Now, if that doesn't get you excited, the National Radio Club's Antenna Pattern Book, the 7th edition, is now available. This all-new edition is prepared by National Radio Club member Paul Swearingen and is an all-inclusive book of patterns of both daytime and nighttime operation of stations in the United States, Canada, and selected foreign countries. The data for this book comes from the 34th edition of the AM Radio Log and National Radio Club's John Callerman's Comprehensive Mexican Station Listing. The book comes shrink-wrapped in 8.5x11 three-hole punch format for placement in your own three-ring binder. Here's a hint. Get yourself a 1.25-inch three-ring binder notebook, and you can put both your log and the pattern book in it. There are 240 pages, and the book has maps covering 530 through 1700 kilohertz, depicting the lower U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Hawaii and Alaska are shown on separate maps of the book. Here's the information to order. To the United States, $22.95, $28.95 for non-members. Add $3.85 for priority mail to U.S. addressees. To Canada, $35. Air mail outside of the U.S. and Canada, $39. For those outside the U.S., use PayPal or money order in U.S. funds only. Order from the National Radio Club's Publication Center, 473-251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251. Or you can go on to www.nrcdxas.org. Colorado residents, please add 3.5% sales tax.
Canada will require all stations to participate in the country's emergency alert system. It's been mandatory in the U.S. for many years, but voluntary in Canada. Now Canada's CRTC is laying the same obligation on all radio and TV stations, cable and satellite operators, and video on demand services by March 31, 2015. Campus, community-based, and native broadcasters have an additional year to comply. Note that the Canadian Emergency Communication System includes not only warnings about forest fires, weather, hazardous chemical spills, and other disasters, but also Amber Alerts, which originated in the Dallas radio market for missing children. Starting in 2015, Canadians will receive timely warnings over the radio and through their televisions in the event of an emergency situation. Emergency alert messages are issued by public officials to warn of dangers to the public and could include notifications about severe weather, wildfires, hazardous chemical spills, train derailments, or water contamination. Messages issued under the system must follow specific guidelines to ensure they are easily recognized by members of the public. According to Jean-Pierre Blaise, CRTC chairman, during an emergency situation, important information can be relayed quickly to Canadians over the radio and through their televisions. We are making sure that broadcasters and television service providers play their part in improving the security and safety of Canadians. Today's decision ensures that Canadians will have access to important local safety messages when these notifications are issued by authorities. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Chris Gay.
Voice of America Delano site goes on the block. This article was written by James O'Neill in Radio World magazine on March 10th of 2014. Delano, the last remaining Voice of America World War II-era shortwave transmitting station, was officially closed down due to budget cuts in September of 2007. by its operating authority, the International Board of Broadcasting, a major support element of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. I authored an article about Delano's closing, Last of the VOA Wartime Transmitting Stations Goes Dark, in RadioWorld.com. Keyword, wartime. And offered a bit of history about this station, which was constructed and operated for the government by the Columbia Broadcasting System. It had gone on the air in late 1944 under the direction of the Office of Wartime Information, which later became the Voice of America. A recent posting to the Radio World website asked, "So, as of 2013, what has become of this site?" Having spent several months of my life at the Southern California Transmitting Station, called a relay station back then, I was curious myself and started making calls. At the time of my publication of my initial article in 2008, it was believed that the Delano Transmitting Station might be placed in mothball status and could possibly reopen. Dixon, a sister station in Northern California, was closed in 1979 and reactivated in 1983. It operated for another 5 years before a permanent closure and dismantling. Some proponents hoped that if it was not reactivated, Delano could be made into a museum to show future generations what high-power shortwave broadcasting was like. When the Delano plant closed, it was operating with four ASEA Brown Boveri 250,000-watt transmitters, but it also depended upon a 1960s vintage Collins 250-kilowatt unit as well. All of the really old stuff, the original World War II vintage Federal 200,000-watt transmitter, and a couple of 1940 GE 200,000-watt rigs had been removed years ago before the 2007 closing. But the core building, including its wartime guard shack, had seen little change and provided a good idea of what high-frequency, high-power broadcasting was all about. The homeless shelter. However, turn to the end of 2013, and I found that neither scenario was going to be played out. I contacted David Evans, a supervisory property management officer with the IBB, and I learned that the Delano facility had been turned over to the General Services Administration for disposal. Here's the way the GSA listed the parcel of land. Property description. The site consists of 800 acres located in the city of Delano, Kern County, California, about 35 miles north of Bakersfield and 75 miles south of Fresno. The property is composed of one parcel that is approximately 1 square mile, 640 acres, and three adjacent parcels measuring approximately 160 acres. There are 12 buildings and structures on the site, including a transmitter building, warehouse, and pump station. The total square footage of all 12 buildings and structures is 32,433 square feet. The site also contains numerous satellite receivers, transmitters, and antennas. The main transmitter building and all the associated buildings are located on a larger parcel. Evans informed me that early on, United States Marine Corps had expressed interest in acquiring the Delano compound for use as a training facility. He stated that the Corps had inspected the facility in September of 2012 and initiated the acquisition process by submitting a interim use agreement until the facility could be acquired. United States Marine Corps interest waned. After that, GSA was legally obligated to offer up the property to the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development for possible use as a shelter for the homeless. However, as early as December 2013, HUD had made no move to acquire it. My check in mid-January with the San Francisco GSA office, which has jurisdiction over the property, revealed that the window was still open for interested parties to acquire it for homeless shelter purposes. If there were no takers by mid-February, the property would be offered for sale to the public. However, one last check with the GSA shortly before publication revealed that the invitation to organizations that might wish to use the Delano facility to house the homeless had been extended until late April. So Delano could still wind up as a homeless shelter, but if that doesn't happen by the deadline, it will be placed on the GSA auction block for sale to the highest bidder, and could eventually be developed into housing, offices, warehouse facilities, or any number of other purposes, including farming. The Delano plant is in the heart of California's fertile San Joaquin Valley farmland, with a number of almond and citrus groves nearby. But it seems likely that the 70-year-old facility will never again be used for broadcasting purposes. Slip sliding away. Delano's permanent closing and dissolution reflects the general global downsizing of shortwave broadcasting since the end of the Cold War. Upon learning of the disposing of the Delano transmitting station, George Woodard, who was vice president of engineering at Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty for 10 years and IBB director of engineering between 1997 and 2000, offered these words. I have to admit that some of the international broadcast functionality is being replaced by other media, so shortwave is not as important as it used to be, said Woodard. But we should have kept Delano as a backup facility. I feel that it's important to keep both Delano and the IBB's Greenville, North Carolina transmitting station, as they are located on the country's coasts and both are on U.S. property. Greenville is especially important because of its coverage into Africa and the Caribbean. The government's Greenville Site B HF transmitting station is still operational and was featured in an April 2011 Radio World article, 48-year-old and still a flamethrower. However, its sister facility, Site A, was shut down several years earlier and remains in mothball status. The IBB's Bethany, Ohio transmitting station was permanently closed in 1994. Woodard also offered his thoughts on continued cutbacks and elimination of services by many of the world's shortwave broadcasters, who cite declining listenerships. I feel like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They close the station and then discover that nobody is listening. According to Evans, IBB transmitting stations are still operating in Kuwait, Sri Lanka, Germany, Botswana, São Tomé, and also Saipan, as well as the Mariana Islands, Bangkok, Thailand, and the Philippines. Shortly after the 2007 Delano closure, Mike Dereau, manufacturer of audio level meters and a broadcast historian and archivist, launched a campaign to save the facility, offering a plan to turn it into a broadcasting museum. It's just tragic, said Dereau. I know that times have changed, but I really feel bad about it. If I could have afforded it, I would have bought the Delano facility myself just to preserve it. We're just selling this country out inch by inch. James O'Neill is a technology editor for the publication TV Technology and Radio World. He writes in Radio World about broadcast history and technical pioneers.
The DX Time Machine. 75 years ago, from the August 9, 1939 DX News, Harold Criswell, Spring Grove, Pennsylvania, reported that the 1938-39 DX season was the best in several years, with some of the 100-watt West Coast stations being heard with almost unbelievable signal strength. From the July 12, 1939 DX News, Chester Komorowski, Norwich, Connecticut, reported 36 new foreign stations this year, including three from Argentina and two from Brazil. 50 years ago, from the August 15, 1964 DX News, Ray Edge concluded his tenure as DX News publisher to be succeeded by Dick Cooper, and Pete Taylor prepared to turn over IDXD to John Kellerman. From the July 18, 1964 DX News, news station PJB on 800 kHz in Bonaire was widely heard with test broadcasts. Plans to be on the air soon with Trans World Radio and Radio Nederlands programming. 25 years ago, from the August 21st, 1989 DX News. New AM stations on the air include KPUP 540, Carmel Valley, California, WWFE 670, Miami, Florida, WRZN 720, Hernando, Florida, WELX 1160, Callahan, Florida, KBET 1220, Santa Clarita, California, and KTFJ 1250, Dakota City, Nebraska. From the July 24th, 1989 DX News, the FCC announced that it would move to computerize its call letter database, until now maintained in longhand on card files. That'll be much to the relief of AM switch editor Jerry Starr. 10 years ago, from the August 16th, 2004 DX News, a de-expedition report from the winter solstice at Wainakaroa, New Zealand, included North American logs, including Bahamas 1540 and KQWB 1660. From the July 12th, 2004 DX News, Mark Connolly, Neil Kazaros, and others discussed Mark's experiments in phasing temporary antennas for beachfront de-expeditions. The wire versus the whip seemed to work best.
Radio remains king of the road despite rise of digital music. This story was written by Phil Izzo in the Wall Street Journal, September 4th. People increasingly get their music through services like Pandora or iTunes, but that old codger, the radio, still rules the road in the United States. More than half of Americans listen to AM/FM radio nearly every time they get in a car, while 86% listen to it at least some time of the week, according to a poll conducted earlier this year by Edison Research and charted by Statista. That compares to just 13% who say that most of the time they listen to some form of digital music, such as through an iPhone or MP3 player. More people, 15%, still listen to CDs when they're driving. Digital music use is higher when you look at people who say they never listen to it, but radio and CDs still outpace all forms of digital music. Radio also remains the most common way for people to keep up with new music. Some 75% say they listen to the radio to stay up to date, while 66% get new music from friends and family. YouTube and Pandora come in third and fourth with 59% and 48% respectively. Young people, though, are still likely to use digital services. YouTube takes the top spot amongst those 12 to 24-year-olds, with 83% of them using the site to keep up with new music. Friends, family, and Pandora are tied up for the second spot with 71%. Even among young people, 65% still use radio to stay up to date. Radio's dominance in the car probably has a lot to do with its ubiquity and cost. The average age of a vehicle in the United States is 11.4 years, the oldest ever. That means most cars on the road were built when digital music was in its infancy. The iPhone launched 7 years ago, and the first Android phone came out less than 6 years ago. The standard radio in 2003 may have come with a CD player, but it probably didn't have an auxiliary jack for the MP3 player. Consumers' taste in car stereos and what they can expect as standard are surely changing, as more cars are built with stereos that are made to connect to smartphones. Digital music and internet radio should start to be more popular on the road. Now, according to the CRTC, Canadians listen to 19.3 hours of radio per week. It's down slightly from 19.6. Like their American neighbors, the media consumption patterns of Canadians are more variegated than ever. A little less listening to traditional AM/FM radio, and a real mix of audio consumption across satellite radio and online. Though the CRTC regulators say growth of satellite radio subscriptions was essentially static in 2013. About 17% of the English speakers subscribe, up to 16% from the previous year. French speakers remain at a much lower level, only about 7% of the population. The report says adoption of AM/FM online streaming remains the same, 22% among English speakers and 14% among French speakers. And about 18% of the Canadians used personalized online music streaming services was last year, though not Pandora. It's not doing business in Canada yet, owing to a licensing issue. That can help explain why streaming levels seem relatively low. I should mention that revenues stayed flat last year for Canadian radio owners. The gain was slightly, just 0.1%, from $1.62 billion in Canadian to $1.623 billion, or about $1.48 billion in U.S. That's for what Canada calls private commercial stations. Its own national service has just begun selling a limited amount of advertising, but we just don't have those figures yet. On the TV side, commercial television revenues were also off just slightly, down 0.2% to $6.5 billion, about $5.97 billion U.S. The CRTC expects its licensees to contribute to the country and especially to nourish its cultural growth. The agency says radio stations invested over $52 million Canadian to the creation of Canadian content and the support of Canadian artists. You can find the 2014 State of the Broadcast Industry report at dxas.org/1410CA. That's all small letters. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Fred Vobey in Lima, Ohio. 610.